By the way, Galen, I realized I hadn't been recording until recently. Is that going to create a huge nightmare?
I hate Mondays. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. There are just 7 weeks until Election Day, and we have a packed show today. Recent polling shows President Trump doing comparatively well with Latino voters in Florida. According to two polls, he's pulled even with Biden amongst Latino voters in Miami-Dade County and improved his deficit with that group statewide by 10 points. So we're going to dig into those trends. We'll also discuss how significant news events or scandals shape the public's view of Trump. During the past couple weeks, unflattering news reports about the president have come out, about him denigrating American troops and misleading the public on the severity of the coronavirus. But do these kinds of reports actually affect his standing in the polls? And we've also got a good use or bad use of polling about Midwestern polling misses. So here with me to discuss it all, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us, senior politics writer, Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Hey, Gil.
Before I get to any of the things that I just mentioned, we're going to kick things off with a new segment called 346. And this segment comes courtesy of President Trump at a rally over the weekend. So let's roll the tape.
So how about the guy the New York Times hired, this pollster, this great genius? He never called one wrong. I don't know, 346. I don't know what the hell. It's like, it's called 340. What's his number? What's his deal? Yeah, it's Silver. Silver. Nate Silver. They pay him a fortune. He said, I think he gave us a 2% chance, a 3% chance. Donald Trump has the 3% chance today of winning. The damn thing was over by 10 o'clock. We were given a very tiny chance. What chance did he give us? Like 9%, something like that, you know? They gave him millions of dollars shortly before because he never called one wrong. He called that one wrong.
So, Nate, is there anything in there that you'd like to correct?
You did used to work for the New York Times. I'm going to embroider all of this on a pillow and give it to you for Christmas.
I did used to work for the New York Times. We were not there in 2016. 538 is now a part of the Walt Disney Empire. I don't think he correctly cited the percentage chance that we gave, which was 29%, which was much higher than other forecasts, higher than betting markets, higher than the conventional wisdom. And although Kellyanne Conway once reprimanded me for daring to say this, was the same chance the Trump campaign themselves gave their candidate, about 30%. But no, I mean, obviously, if you read this website or follow the podcast, then you know we were kind of running around screaming, Trump does have a chance in 2016. You know, one of the annoying things is I think we kind of do get kind of associated with other forecasts that had Trump with a lower shot.
Do you think Trump is going to listen to the podcast today?
Consumes a lot of media. It's a little esoteric for Trump.
He might listen to us while he jogs, you know?
Possible, right? We are all about the possible. It's possible President Trump is running a 5K and has us on his AirPods right now, right? Running around the Rose Garden or whatnot, right? Possible.
In fact,
likely? No.
If you're listening right now, Mr. President, hello to you from 346.
And we're happy to come on, have you as a guest and discuss electoral strategy. It would seem to me, Mr. President, that if you're listening to this podcast, that you would pay more attention to states like Arizona and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. We've read reports that you're not advertising as much there, trying to defend Georgia and whatnot. I've got news for you, Mr. President. If you have to defend Georgia, it's kind of too late. You probably already lost, so go ahead and fight for Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and those races that gave you the win in 2016.
All right, there is your free campaign advice from what's his name, what's his deal?
Nate did a very good pivot to the serious, but I want to know how many text messages you got yesterday from people being like, I just heard the president talk about you.
I think people know that, like, I'd probably find it mildly annoying, so I didn't get too much, but yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our usual recurring segment. I don't know, maybe we'll come back to our new 346 segment at some point in the future. But first...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Today's good use of polling or bad use of polling example comes from Sean Trende at Real Clear Politics. He wrote an article called "Have Pollsters Figured Out How to Poll the Midwest?" And he suggests that they may not have, despite pollsters now weighting their samples by education to address the big gap between the preferences of college-educated and non-college-educated white voters. Trende points to polling errors in the region in 2018, after weighting by education became more common, to say that pollsters could still be underestimating Republicans. He said that he's not suggesting this will necessarily happen in 2020, but that it's something to be aware of. I'm curious, having read Sean Trende's article, his view on this, what could pollsters still be missing, even if they're waiting for education?
So I don't necessarily accept the premise here about how polls did in 2018. I'm good friends with Sean. You know, he and I see eye to eye on a lot of things. To me, it looks like you have some fairly funky results in 2018, where there are some states like Indiana and Missouri where Democrats were considerably overestimated. There are others like Minnesota where they were underestimated. Some like the governor's race in Michigan where the polls were pretty accurate, or Wisconsin, the polls were pretty accurate. So I don't necessarily see. So what I do see actually here is, like, in states that are pretty red, like Indiana and Missouri, that were important states in 2018, that's where a lot of the error comes in. And that's not necessarily uncommon. It's not uncommon for a candidate, for Republicans to do better than their polls suggest in red states, and Democrats in blue states. Is one reason why you might combine a poll with some type of prior based on partisanship, for example. So I just think the data is not totally straightforward on this question. Nationwide in 2018, the polls were unbiased. That doesn't mean that, like, there couldn't have been bias in certain regions. So, you know, there were some states like Arizona and Texas where Beto didn't win, but he came closer than polls showed. Arizona, Democrats did better than polls showed. Nevada, right? So there are states where Democrats beat their polls. There are states where they underperform their polls. California, in a lot of the congressional races, they overperform. So I don't necessarily see 2018 as a reason to be alarmed by the polls. It was a pretty good year for the polls. Now, if you are a pollster who is still not waiting on education, then that could create some problems for sure. There are also some theories that, you know, because turnout was so high, I mean, remember, turnout was like over half of the voting eligible population turned out in 2018, which is very rare for a midterm. It's usually 38% or something like that. So if you have very, very high turnout, then that can kind of help Trump in the Midwest, because you get, like, kind of working class white voters who may not have voted midterms before. It can also help Democrats in, say, Arizona, because there are Hispanics or younger voters who hadn't voted before, who weren't expected to turn out, who did. So that might explain it. But I mean, 2018 was one of the most accurate years for the polls ever.
I guess what you're saying here is that waiting by education matters, but we're also relying on pollsters' turnout models, which can be important and be a source of polling error as well. Is that fair to say?
For sure. I mean, there are, you know, there are dozens of methodological decisions that pollsters have to make. How you weight a poll and how you create a turnout model is obviously two big categories there. But look, in general, there is not a lot of carryover in polling error from one election to the next. And the reason for that is that pollsters can actually try to correct themselves, right? Every pollster polling Wisconsin is aware that polls underestimated Trump in Wisconsin in 2016. Some of them might say, okay, nothing wrong with the poll. Undecided voters broke toward Trump, so we're going to keep using the same methodology. We can't really predict what undecideds are going to do, so nothing wrong with the poll. Some might say, oh my gosh, now we have to wait for education. Some might say, oh my gosh, we now have to make four adjustments, all of which help Trump and kind of wind up overcompensating. One of the reasons why people, like, I think are sometimes foolish to try to outthink polling averages is that polling averages themselves are, like, it's not a constant target. The pollsters themselves have incentives and have a memory of past events, and they have, you know, and they want to be correct.
I guess what jumped out to me about Sean's story and I thought was important was I was assigned to cover the governor's races in 2018. And I think Gillum was ahead of DeSantis in pretty much every poll I saw. So DeSantis winning struck me as surprising. Ohio and Iowa, the Democratic governor candidates, were like closer in projections than they end up being. So I'm not an expert on like what exactly those polls got wrong. And I agree that 2018 had good polling overall. But I do think if this race comes down to like three or four states, if it gets like much closer, then I think I would be sort of looking very closely at if the average of the polls say Biden's ahead by three in Florida, I'm not certain that means Biden's going to win Florida. That's kind of what I was getting at. I think that it reminded me that there is some reason to look for polling error without necessarily me knowing exactly why.
Because we're talking about the significance of the gap in preferences between college-educated and non-college-educated white voters, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, and it gets talked about a lot in politics in general. Why is there such a significant gap where there wasn't one before, and should we expect that gap to keep growing?
There's been a lot of literature written, particularly post-2016, that the election, and frankly, Barack Obama's presidency, sped up whites without a college education's, as a broad group, affiliation of parties with racial or racialized politics. Basically, the idea that they realized that the Democratic Party is perhaps more racially, politically correct, and the Republican Party is less so. Like, there was this alignment of racial identity politics with certain parties that Barack Obama's presidency helped accelerate. That's one theory of it, and that they just kind of felt like Trump was speaking their language, you know. So that's one theory. But it's something that had been, it was a trend that had been going on for a while that was just accelerated.
I looked up this data from Pew, and it looks like from until 2007, white non-college voters were about equally divided between the parties. Then there was a big divergence starting in 2007. Among white college-educated voters, they were pretty similar to the parties until 2015. Then you saw a big divergence. So one like short story would be the sort of the rise of Barack Obama sort of drove away in his politics, drove away white working class people from the Democratic Party. And then college educated people have been driven off by Trump and his rise. That's a very simple story. I'm sure there's a lot going on. But the fact that the trend started in 2007 and 2015, I think, is very remarkable.
Yeah, I would recommend, since I think maybe our podcast audience has an appetite for this, Identity Crisis, the book about the 2016 election, has some very helpful chapters on this, talking about this long-term trend in these demographic groups.
So this education divide amongst white voters gets plenty of play, as we've discussed. Looking at the polling, it doesn't look like there is an education gap amongst voters of color. So you could say that in general, 90% of black voters vote for Democrats. So maybe, although there may be many divides amongst the black electorate, college, just like many other things, whether they're more conservative, moderate, or liberal, they end up voting oftentimes for the Democrat. But Latino voters, of course, there is more of a divide where it's two-thirds and a third. So why don't we see this education gap, I guess, amongst voters of color in the same way we see it amongst white voters?
So one important factoid, I looked this up from the Census Bureau, 40% of non-Hispanic white people who are over 25, so most people who are non-Hispanic and white, among that group, 40% of them have college degrees. Among black people, that number is 26%. Among Hispanics, that group is 19%. So one way to start with it is there's a way more opportunity to have a big divide between white college grads and non-white college grads, because both groups are pretty big. The number of Hispanic and black college graduates is much lower. What I'm going to look for, I think the short answer to your question is, I'm not sure why there's not an education divide among blacks or Latinos. The black one, I think, is explained by the fact that blacks are so democratic. The Latino one, I actually think, is a harder question. I want to look at some more evidence. But one thing I think you might start seeing is a lot of the polls that I've seen suggest that among blacks, there is more college graduates are more liberal. And so I wonder if you start seeing that in Democratic primaries. Like I think if we had ended up with, say, Elizabeth Warren versus Joe Biden being the final two, I think you probably would have seen more liberal African Americans, and those with, you know, more like college or postgraduate degrees would have been more favorable to Warren than the rest of the group. I think Biden would have won the group, but I think that's what I'm looking for next, is that you're seeing a little bit of and there's not a lot of polling that breaks down black people by degree versus non-degree, but there is polling that shows the degree group is more liberal. And so, because, you know, most black people say they are moderate. So if you end up with a moderate liberal divide, this base education, I think that's a potential in the future.
Yeah, I guess, does anyone else have thoughts on, you know, the education divides that exist in amongst the American public and how this plays out in 2020? I think that in general, people assume that these trends will continue. But, you know, I guess Nate's motto is, well, sometimes there's just mean reversion instead of trends continuing all the time. Is there a reason to believe that we're in a situation where these trends will continue to become exacerbated, or evidence of mean reversion already?
I think there's two answers. One is a sociological explanation, and one is mean reversion. Maybe Nate should speak to the mean reversion one.
What's the sociological explanation?
The sociological one is that we're currently undergoing a big conversation nationally. I hate that term, conversation, but you guys know what I mean, about race and identity. And people who are part of the elite, people who are college educated, spend more time academicizing their daily life and the interactions that they have, and therefore, and maybe read more of the kind of news that talks about it, and therefore are more aware of like racial identities and which parties adhere to which interpretations of racial identity and what's okay and what's not okay. As far as mean reversion, take it away, Nate.
I mean, it's just the idea that, like, typically if you look at how a state votes from election to election, you actually want to use a mix of the most recent election and the second most recent election. So, for example, if Texas gets much more purple from 2012 to 2016, right, a lot of people would say, okay, well, now it's going to be fully purple by 2020, right? And empirically, the answer is no, you might expect it to, like, be mostly like 2016, but shift back in the direction of 2012 instead. I should say, by the way, look, if Biden wins the race by 7 points nationally, which is what he's ahead by in polls right now, then everything will look bluer, almost everything, right? So the question is, what looks bluer relative to the national average? And Texas might actually be an example where that is true in Texas, but it's not necessarily true all the time. You know, North Carolina was a state that Obama won in 08, was supposed to be kind of a permanently purple state, and it's given Democrats a lot of problems, although Biden's narrowly ahead in polls there this year. On the other hand, Virginia next door has kind of all the way shifted through, kind of ran through the stop sign, is no longer even like a swing state, really, barely anymore. It's so blue now. So these things are a little bit more hard to predict than people might assume.
I would say the parties are going to adjust. So I think the trends might stop because the parties adjust. Like the Democrats spent a whole primary picking the person they thought would do best with white working class people in their field of candidates. I don't know what the Republicans are doing in 2024 if they lose this race, but I think one outcome is they end up picking as someone who they deem quote unquote electable. And I would assume that means that person annoys white college grads less than Trump does. So I think the parties will probably adjust, and that might therefore mean these trends are not as exasperated as they are right now.
Yeah. And Trump's lack of desire to adapt, although they made some shout outs trying to, you know, there are a lot of non-white faces at the Republican convention, but Trump's comparative lack of interest in adapting and his confidence that this very narrow margin by which he won last time can replicate itself. I mean, that's not necessarily a textbook strategy.
All right. So to put a button on this segment, in terms of expected polling misses in 2020 and the idea that even if you wait for education, there could still be misses based on the data from 2018. Nate, it sounded like you were going to label that a bad use of polling. Is that fair?
No, I wouldn't say it's a bad use. I think the lesson here is that you have to be prepared for polling error, but you shouldn't try to guess in which direction the error will occur. You know, I mean, this has happened time and time again, right? In the 2014 election, there were a lot of liberals who were like, well, polls underrate Democrats. They underrated Democrats in 2012. They underrate turnout among minority groups. And so, no, instead the polls overrated Democrats in 2014. So, you know, that's what our model assumes, is like there is polling error. You don't know which direction it's going to be. And trying to guess can be foolish, in part because pollsters themselves are trying to right their past wrongs. And whether they undercorrect or overcorrect is always an open question.
Let's move on and let's talk about how scandals or significant news events shape perceptions of the president. This is something that we have talked about over the past 4 years, but I think it's worth summing up what we know as we enter the final stretch of the campaign. This is particularly pertinent after the reports about Trump's comments on American troops and the severity of the coronavirus over the past 2 weeks. But it's also likely that negative reports about both candidates could come out before Election Day. So to start, Bob Woodward published tapes last week of his conversations with the president, in which the president said about the coronavirus in early February, quote, "You just breathe the air and that's how it's passed." He goes on to say, "And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than even your strenuous flu." And this was while he was telling the public that it's no worse than the flu and was predicting that it would just go away. And Trump said that he told the public that because he didn't want to create panic. You know, this got a lot of play. Is this a quote-unquote scandal? And should we expect revelations like those tapes to affect the president's standing?
I mean, I think the answer is, of course, it's a scandal that the president seemed to downplay and mislead the public about a deadly virus. So I think it's a scandal. It's a big story. I mean, his comments at the time were not, you know, there were medical experts critiquing his comments at the time. So it's not as if people didn't necessarily know that he might be saying the wrong thing. But I think it's certainly a scandal. Now, will it be a scandal that affects his political standing or his electoral standing? I would say no, because we've had a lot of scandals, from the one we talked about last week to the Russia investigation, to what happened with Ukraine, to Charlottesville, and Trump has been between 39 and 43% the whole time. So I tend to think that not much is going to shake his core support, at least. So in that sense, if scandal means this will take him down, then I think the answer is no. But I think it is we're at this point, we have a lot of evidence that most events are not sort of changing the fundamental dynamics of his support base.
So is it true then that Trump weathers scandals well? I think he's been described as Teflon at certain points throughout his tenure. But is this different from past presidents, the way that Trump and scandal interact?
Yes. There's more of them.
Wait, hold on. He's on track to lose by the widest margin for an incumbent since Jimmy Carter.
Wait, but what was Galen's question, Nate? Galen, repeat your question.
Does Trump weather scandals better than past presidents, essentially? Is the Teflon Trump moniker of sorts true to what is actually happening?
Yeah. So, Nate, like, if the number of scandals that he's had is enormous and his approval rating has never slipped below a certain point because of our partisanship. So in some ways, like, yeah, he weathers scandals differently because there's lots of them, because he's created a culture within his party that creates a permission structure. So I know where you're going, but also, like, there is something different about Trump and scandal, I think, that we have to acknowledge.
But weathering it well, I mean, he's probably going to 75% chance he'll probably lose, and he might lose big. And I think the cumulative effect of all these things probably does have an impact, because he was also behind back in March, kind of pre-COVID/economic collapse.
He didn't get removed from office after being impeached. You could say that. That's weathering a scandal well. Huh?
Well, sure. But I'm not sure if Democrats, I don't know. The public wasn't necessarily clamoring for impeachment. That's a whole other conversation.
Because of the environment in which the country now exists under politically, created by Trump.
Why was Trump losing by 5 or 6 points pre-COVID, pre-economic collapse, despite a good economy, right? And despite kind of objectively good numbers on stuff like that? I mean, it's because I think the effect of people thinking about scandals and dishonesty and his views on race and immigrants, I think those things have an effect. It's not like a flow. It's like a stock effect where it, like, you know, accumulates and makes them unpopular. But, you know, we have a president where, you know, 51% of the country in polls says, I would not even consider voting for him. That's kind of bad. He may win despite it. The polls only have to be a little bit off in the Electoral College and whatever else, right? But, like...
Okay, but Nate, when we've seen past presidents go up in scandal or face challenging economic times, like Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., their approval ratings can get down into the 20s. And so something has happened, maybe it's partisanship, maybe it's Trump, but where it seems like, and we use this word delicately, the president has a floor. That's different. That's a new development in American politics, isn't it?
Yes or no?
Yes or no, sir.
It's not new. Partisanship's a variable that moves in different waves over time. A lot of kind of the current era of, like, political journalists and editors, people who kind of formulate the conventional wisdom, kind of came of age at a time where partisanship was historically quite low, and that can have different effects. Like, it can make public opinion more volatile. But I don't know. I mean, it may just be that, like, there is so much information about Trump that, like, people have kind of decided upon him. But, you know, maybe Biden, if he is elected, maybe his ratings will shift more. I don't know.
Wait, that suggests that it could be specific to Trump.
Beep, beep, beep.
But I'm not sure what you're asking then, because you're trying to make a generalization from, like, a sample of one, you know?
I guess I'm trying to observe how this doesn't seem like the way that approval ratings have behaved in the past, or how scandal and presidencies have interacted in the past. Like, we kind of described the stability of Obama's approval rating as the fact that he didn't have major scandals and there was partisanship, but, like, Trump has had major scandals. Perry or Claire, do you have thoughts on this?
Oh, I'll be honest with you. Like, I'm a little struck by this. I was doing another story and I looked it up, and as Galen is discussing, George Bush's numbers went down to the 20s. In his overall approval rating was in the 20s in his last year and really his last 2 years. And what you saw during that period was Bush's approval rating among Republicans dropped below 70%. So versus with Trump, it's never really dropped below 90%. So maybe Bush's scandals were worse. You can certainly make a case for that. Maybe partisanship is higher 12 years later. You can certainly make a case for that. But I don't think it was immediately obvious to me in February that if 200,000 people died because of COVID-19, and it was generally agreed that Trump handled it pretty poorly, that his approval rating would be basically 43 in February and 43 now. I am surprised by that. I'm not shocked by it, but I'm surprised by it. And I think it's sort of, I'm sort of thinking about what it means. I mean, my temporary theory is it means Trump approved, what people approve of Trump on is more about identity and cultural issues, and so, and what they disagree about is more about cultural identity issues too. That's kind of my temporary thesis, but I don't think 200,000 deaths not moving his rating is surprising to me, and I'm thinking about it a lot.
Yeah, like, obviously having a default prediction that, like, oh, this won't change Trump's approval ratings is far more right than wrong. I mean, there were some shifts around COVID. He went from 43 to a peak of around 46, so that was a bouncer around COVID, then fell to a low of around 40, and now it's kind of bounced back to 43. So there's something going on there. A lot of leaders around the world became more popular because of COVID, at least initially. There's kind of a rally around the flag effect. And as that became the kind of predominant story in the country, then Trump's numbers fell from 46 to 40, which is some real movement. We're doing a little bit better on COVID than we were in the summer as a country. Another theory is that when you get into the heart of an election campaign, then approval becomes less meaningful because it's just a reflection of the presidential ballot. When Trump was down in the dumps in his approval rating, he was like a negative net 16 or something, right? Biden wasn't ahead by 16 points. And there were people who were like, I don't like how Trump's doing, but I'm Republican, I'm going to vote for Trump still. But now it seems silly for someone to say, oh, I don't approve of him, but I'm going to vote for the president. And so I think kind of we're in the zone where approval ratings are maybe less meaningful right now. I don't know.
So I think, Nate, I think that some of the changes that have happened in the approval rating, I do think if we're in a place where approval rating no longer reflects I would say, performance in terms of on like sort of like nonpartisan performance. Like you could talk about like Trump is still trying to limit abortions. So if you are an abortion voter, then Trump is still performing well on in that part of like his job. But the idea that like Bush's ratings really went down amid Hurricane Katrina and they never really came back. And that's an event you can sort of look at in terms of the numbers and show. I'll be curious if Biden is president, he may has a big problem happens on his watch and he can be blamed for, like COVID, if his ratings go down. Because if we're in a world in which basically people in whoever's party will approve of them at 90% rates, no matter what they do, that would be an interesting world. And I don't know if we're there. We don't have the evidence for that, but I don't think it's clear that we're not there anymore. And that makes politics much, much different. If you really can never offend 40% of the electorate, will always be with you if you're winning one of the two parties, that's a different politics than I'm used to, at least.
Yeah. I mean, does anyone else have thoughts on how that reshapes our politics, or if it is reshaping our politics?
We are doing research for our congressional model, and one thing that you see is like what we call candidate quality matters less, right? It matters less now if the candidate is experienced. It matters less now if they have had a scandal, right? And it is a reflection of partisanship.
Interesting. All right. Well, I guess, you know, only time will tell if this is a new fixture or a permanent fixture or a cyclical fixture of American politics. But let's move on and let's talk about some of the trends we're seeing amongst Latino voters this election. But first,
you're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
As I mentioned at the top, so far President Trump appears to have notably improved his standing with Latino voters, at least in Florida. According to a recent Miami Herald poll, Trump and Biden are tied amongst Latinos in Miami-Dade County. Also, a recent poll from the Democratic Latino research firm Aikis Research showed Trump behind with Latino voters statewide by 16 points, which is up from his 27-point deficit in 2016, according to exit polls. So also joining us for this segment is the co-founder of Aikis Research, Carlos Odio. Welcome, Carlos.
Thanks for having me.
So do you have a sense of why exactly Trump has improved his standing with Latinos in Florida?
Yeah, I think it's helpful to look at what happened in 2016. It was an outlier year in many ways. From the moment Trump comes down the escalator, I think a lot of Latino voters were immediately skeptical. And so you see him hit pretty basement levels. He also wasn't trying very hard, one must say, when it came to courting the Hispanic vote in 2016. And you also had a lot of Cubans, even Cuban Republicans, who were skeptical of him. We forget, but there were these stories about Donald Trump doing business in Cuba. And so there were many reasons why folks were holding back. And what happens after his election is a little bit of coming home for many Cubans, I suppose Cuban Republicans. You have a combination of sort of this tough talk on socialism. You have his bluster on Venezuela and Cuba. You have things like the tax cuts and a good economy. And so folks find an excuse to come home. So you see a big shift where in 2018, Nelson and Gillum both underperform relative to Clinton with the Hispanic vote. And so the shift already happened after the 2016 period.
You know, thinking about 2016, even back then, some assumed that Trump's posture on immigration might turn off Latino voters. And in 2016, really, when you look nationwide, it didn't seem to have, right? Trump didn't do any worse than Mitt Romney amongst Hispanic voters. In some places, he may have even done better. Election watchers maybe hypothesized that the talk about the wall and the posture on immigration would hurt him. But is that just putting too much emphasis on the issue of immigration and that there are a bunch of different issues at play and that it's not fair to kind of like focus solely on immigration?
There are a lot of different issues, and there are a lot of different Latino electorates. And I think it's actually very instructive to look at it at a state level, because Trump did very poorly in some places where it really mattered and probably made gains elsewhere. And also, by the way, there's a side conversation to be had about the veracity of exit polling when it comes to Latino voters as well, and hard to pin data. But, you know, immigration undoubtedly moved a bunch of voters in 2016. I think the ones that we're seeing come back now, it's not that they don't care about the immigration issue necessarily. It's not as defining. The ones who have always been more Republican leaning are more removed from that experience. So, you know, third generation Hispanics in places like New Mexico and even Arizona have always been more conservative. They're more removed from that experience. But you even have people who are second generation who are more focused on some set of domestic issues, especially young men who understand the immigration piece but are willing to say, and we hear this in focus groups, he is a racist. You know, we've heard people say, my mom's undocumented. So I think this is all very unfair. But and you hear whatever it is that that folks are using to justify it, usually some sort of economic argument.
Carlos, I'm curious, can you maybe give us a little bit of a topology of like the Florida Hispanic vote? Because obviously we hear a lot about Cubans in Miami being more conservative, and then we'll hear a lot of Republicans say, well, in addition to the fact that they're strongly anti-communist, Hispanics are a naturally conservative constituency because they're largely religious, Catholic, moving to evangelical. Like, give us a little bit of like a breakdown of Florida in particular. And if you want to, you know, move it out a little bit, because it's obviously, as you pointed out, a pretty diverse coalition.
Yeah, Claire, how much time you've got? This is like a whole college course we could do on this. No, it's so complex, right? I mean, Florida already is five different states as it is, right? And then you add in the Hispanic piece, and it's so complicated, right? So look, just shy of 30% of the Hispanic vote in Florida is Cuban American. And increasingly, that is U.S.-born Cubans. But you also have waves of Cubans. You have the ones who arrived, like my parents' generations in the 50s and 60s. You have those who arrived in the 80s. And you have the ones who arrived after the 90s. They're fascinating in its own because they used to be very progressive, and they've now swung to Donald Trump. So you have all of these different dynamics within the Cuban vote. You then have, by eligibility and registration, about even, but in voting a little bit less, you have the Puerto Rican vote, heavily concentrated in Orlando. There, you know, you have folks who've been here for a while. You have even a lot of New Yorkers who relocated to Florida who are more Democratic overall. The people who came more from the island and are more connected to the experience on the island are less connected to the U.S. political system, less familiarity with the two-party system. The parties in Puerto Rico are entirely defined by what you think the political status of Puerto Rico should be. And so you come to Orlando and it's entirely foreign in multiple ways, even though Puerto Ricans instantly are eligible. You have a growing evangelical movement within the Puerto Rican vote, right? It's very complicated in all these ways. And then you have more than 40% of the vote in Florida that's neither Cuban nor Puerto Rican, but we talk about less. And it's this constellation of 18 other nationalities, whether it's Nicaraguan, Peruvian, Dominican, Colombian, Venezuelans, who are, by the way, only fifth on that list, even though we talk about them as much as we do. And a set of other groups who each have their own set of interests. Some are more connected to the Latin American foreign policy. Some are like the Mexican-American vote, where 77% are U.S. born. They're the children and grandchildren of farm workers. And obviously that's very different from the Southwest, where you have more of a Mexican-American descent, but you also have those whose parents or grandparents came from Mexico, and those who, like my co-founder Stephanie Valencia, would say, we didn't cross the border crossed us. And they're multi-generational.
Carlos, is the foreign policy connection that we traditionally associated with Cuban-American voters and now maybe more Venezuelan voters, is that a strong pull in Florida? Is that a reason why Trump could be doing better? People having a different conception of what a political leader should be, maybe they like the idea of Trump's style. How much should we read into that foreign policy connection?
Look, if you're in Miami, it dominates, right, the way we talk about these things. I'm a little bit of a contrarian on this point, which I think those for whom it is the most important are very vocal. And so we think that the vote choice is entirely shaped by that. There are voters for whom this is a threshold question. Are you good on Cuba? Yes or no? And then I'll hear you on the rest of it. However, and now, of course, Trump is making a push for Venezuelans, for Nicaraguans, for Colombians, on this very anti-socialist message as well. I would say, though, and if you hear how Trump talks about it, I think there's a little bit of a trap. It's not entirely about the foreign policy aspect of it. It's a domestic policy concern, right? Especially once you move beyond a core that's all about foreign policy. There's a much broader set of voters who are just concerned about what applying quote-unquote socialist ideas in a U.S. context could mean for them and for economic opportunity. That harkens back to the reasons they came to the U.S. Opportunity, family. And so there, for Democrats, there's this huge opening on things like healthcare. COVID recovery is just dominating everything because it's undermining all the reasons that folks came to the country. They came for more opportunity. You've got a lot of Venezuelans who are in the gig economy driving Uber and Lyft. And now that's been undermined by this crisis that Donald Trump has totally bungled. So I would say it's not as simple as saying, is this about Maduro and Castro? There is it's just now intricately tied with domestic politics as well.
It seems like a lot of times when Democrats are trying to appeal to Latino voters, and we also saw this during the Democratic National Convention, they're talking about immigration. Is that a data-based strategy? Like, do we know that Latino or Hispanic voters in America care most about immigration? Or is it things like you mentioned, like COVID-19, the economy, healthcare, things that all voters care about? What does the polling tell us about how big of an issue immigration actually is?
Gillen, again, it comes down to what do we mean by immigration? What is it, a particular set of policies? Because that's not really it. I think there's a way in which immigration really is a stand-in for does this candidate accept the Latinos or not? Is this candidate racist, right? Is this candidate a nativist? And that has wider impact than just a question of, do you think we should build a wall? Do you think we should have a pathway to citizenship? I can tell you, family separation, kids in cages has wide resonance, even with those who are more conservative and would tell you that Donald Trump has a point on other aspects of immigration policy, will still say these other issues, they're a matter of morality and humanity. When it comes to an actual policy platform, yeah, the concerns of Latinos are the concerns of everyone else in those same communities, which in this moment are heavily about COVID and COVID adjacent questions like the reopening of schools or healthcare and covering any fallout from COVID, like jobs coming out of COVID.
I'm curious, Carla, what do you make about the apparent divergence between Arizona and Florida? Because Arizona is maybe the single state where Biden is like polling the best relative to 2016, and Florida's a state where he's polling maybe the worst, right? At least of the swing states, where he's barely ahead there, despite his big lead nationally.
I hate to oversimplify, but so much of this is the Cubans. I mean, the Cuban vote just looks a lot more like the white vote. If you take out the Cubans and you look at how Biden is doing with non-Cuban Hispanics in Florida, it's closer to a 60-30 split, which looks a lot more like the polling that we have in the Mountain West, Southwest states. Now, there is some difference in Florida because you have other groups that coexist in media markets with the Cubans. And so if you look in Miami, great article in Politico today about the level of disinformation that spreads in South Florida. I'm not usually one to put too much credence in all this, but the reality is it is dominant, not just on YouTube or WhatsApp, which WhatsApp is a plague on its own, but on local TV and local newspapers actively spreading QAnon and anti-Semitic tropes. So that, I think, affects a lot of the Florida piece. Now, Arizona is very different. So much of the population is in Maricopa. It's very urban. So much of the vote there is shaped by the experience of SB 1070, the anti-immigrant law from now 10 years ago. But, you know, I wouldn't take Arizona for granted either in this regard. We have some numbers that'll be coming out tomorrow. And you do see some tightening, which I think is the effect of a competitive environment when it comes to the Latino vote. And I think the non-Cuban Hispanic vote in Florida and Arizona are probably actually in some ways converging.
How much do you trust the national polls to accurately sample the Hispanic vote?
Great question. Well, and that's actually the other answer when it comes to Florida versus Arizona, which is it's much easier to poll Arizona. Not that it's easy, but it's certainly easier than polling Florida. Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is, if you are actually trying to get a representative sample of Latinos, there are other questions you'd have to ask that are not being asked in your standard national poll because there isn't space for it. You know, you'd be asking, what is your place of origin? You'd be asking what country were you, were you U.S. born or were you born in another country? You'd be asking, were your parents born in this country? Because all these things, what generation you are, place of origin, so on and so forth, are highly predictive of the vote. Cuban being, I hate to keep coming back to it, but it's just so unique in that you could take someone with a demographic profile, identical, two voters identical the same who are Latino, and I then tell you that one of them is Cuban, the likelihood that they will be Trump supporting is drastic, jumps drastically. And then there's the modal, and then there's the actual methodological piece of this, which is, are you doing bilingual phone calls? Because a Spanish speaker, someone who is uniquely Spanish speaking, is a very different voter. If you're not doing Spanish, you're missing out on a lot of foreign born. You're missing out on a lot of the non-college vote, more of the Democratic vote. If you're not doing landlines in Florida, you're missing out on where most of the Cubans can be found. You're also missing out on other non-college. So I have many reasons why I'd say a grain of salt on any of the public polling in this regard. It's instructive to put side by side, but any one poll that is not asking these kinds of questions is just going to have a hard time accurately gauging.
I do wonder if, like, because all these different variables like education and income kind of cut across Hispanic voters differently than they do for white voters, I do wonder if any of this is an artifact of how they're weighting and modeling, but it seems like it could be a hard problem at least. The premise here is partly because, like, obviously there's been a lot of focus on the states where Trump overperformed his polls. We talked about that a little bit at the top of the show, Republicans did. In a lot of the states with heavy Latino populations, Nevada, Arizona, you know, the House races in California in 2018, Democrats have beaten their polls, sometimes by a fair bit, Texas a little bit. So one interpretation of that might be that for some reason these polls are not capturing how blue the Hispanic vote is necessarily. I don't know.
Right. I mean, there's this question of you always have a larger undecided bucket when it comes to Latino polls, right? And the possibility that Latinos underrepresent, sort of understate, not just their vote choice, but also their intention to vote. I think these are legitimate questions for which we don't have great answers. Or is it a matter of are voters playing coy and aren't expressing how definite they are relative to the reality? Or do we have a population that is late deciding? Not just late deciding in terms of choosing between two candidates, but late deciding in terms of, am I going to vote or not? I think there seems to be research that would indicate that the latter is probably right, that there is just a sense that that this decision overall is being made kind of late in the cycle.
Is there any sense that Hispanic voters are withholding their vote intentions from pollsters because they don't want to give out private information?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that was maybe more the case. I'm not going to get into a shy Trump voter debate. But actually, I think in some ways with the Latino voter, it might have, what I'd say is when you look at 2016 and you look at today, and you look at the polling of where we were in August of 2016, and you look at the polling today, Trump is doing much better. He's just doing much better. And I wonder to what extent that is a function of voters in 2016 truly not wanting to say that they were with Trump if you were Latino, that there were social pressure reasons not to do so. Whereas today, maybe they're a little bit more open about it. But the other explanation is just more straightforward, which is that, again, folks were skeptical of him in 2016, and that now there's been, quote unquote, more of a normalization, where Trump overperforms with white voters, and now he's coming back down to earth, that with Latinos in certain key states, like Arizona and Nevada, that he underperformed, and now there's maybe a little bit more of a regression to the mean.
You mentioned that being Cuban is a strong indicator of supporting Trump or identifying as Republican. In general, we think of the Latino vote breaking down by about a third as reliably Republican, two-thirds somewhat reliably Democratic. What are the other key indicators for how voters will break along that Democratic-Republican line apart from being Cuban?
Yeah, good question. So interestingly, education is not one of them. You don't see a lot of difference on college, non-college, with one exception in some states, which is among young men. So you see a non-college man, younger, under 50 men, who maybe some segment of are now behaving a little bit more like non-college white. But other than that, education is not that predictive. The U.S.-born, foreign-born is a big one. After the Cubans, the most likely to be a Trump voter across battlegrounds is a U.S.-born man of Mexican descent. The least likely to be Trump-supporting is a Mexican-born woman. Gender is enormous. The gender divide is massive, and it is aggravated by questions of, again, place of birth, and generation in the country. Whenever I get a pullback, the first thing we look at is the age-gender split. Age is just another big one, and it cuts differently on what state you're looking at as well.
Can I ask, I do not speak Spanish, and so I, you know, can read all I want about Hispanics and perceptions of Trump in America, but like, let's set aside, you know, newspaper articles or whatever. Spanish-speaking pop culture, like, how is it, in America, like, how is it handling Trump? Like, what is, do you have a sense of why, like, young men, I can't remember if you said native-born or foreign-born, are more likely to be Trump-supporting.
U.S. But, like, born.
What are some, U.S.-born. What are the ways that over the past 4 years, Hispanics in the U.S. have sort of digested Trump? Because he's so controversial on race and immigration that I think, like, particularly people in, like, predominantly white media have certain expectations of how the vote should go. And obviously it's a lot more up in the air than we might think. So I'm kind of curious about how Trump has been digested by pop culture or Spanish-speaking pop culture in the U.S.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it speaks to another variable I forgot to mention, which is also urbanicity, right? I mean, urban Latino versus rural is a stark difference. And so this comes actually back to, like, so what communities are you in and what media are you consuming jointly, right? And a lot of the reason I think you have a growth in Trump vote is among voters who are occupying space with a lot of white voters and are getting a lot of the same media. So you have younger men who are on the same Reddit channels, getting the same, or whatever it is that folks are looking at, getting a lot of the same information, right? And so it's these networks. What networks are folks in? When you have, I think, especially Latinas, women, who are in densely populated areas where they're working and living in spaces with other Latinas, the image of Trump is what you would expect it to be, right? I know your question is about pop culture,
but
you have to be consuming the media in Spanish to be getting that, right? Which is not all Latinos, right? It's a decreasing number of people who are watching Univision for their news about Donald Trump, even though it's a significant number. So if you're watching Univision, I think you would have, and you watch Jorge Ramos's newscast every night, you have a very different conception of Donald Trump than if you are in a more rural part of Wisconsin and you are getting your news from your friends at work and your social media spaces. There's also, you know, closed networks like WhatsApp. And so people aren't getting their news and their depictions of Trump through conventional media anymore. And it's harder to track all of these different channels. But there's, you know, I keep coming back to WhatsApp because it is pervasive, right? I mean, Latinos use WhatsApp at a higher rate than any other group in the U.S. And it is rife with disinformation. The tías and abuelas of WhatsApp is like a whole thing. You know, in a focus group, somebody says something nutty and you immediately know they're going to say they saw it on WhatsApp, right? It's like reliably.
I mean, what's an example of something like that? Like the kinds of information going around on WhatsApp?
Oh my goodness. There's your garden variety conspiracies, you know. Maybe it's front of mind just because there are so many stories, but you do have your QAnon adjacent kind of stories that are popping these days. You know, you have this interesting cross flow of information with Latin America, where the Latin American right, you know, creates videos and content that is you know, talking about Democrats as being a puppet of, you know, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and George Soros. That's like the trio, right? Just like a whole bunch of awful tropes. And that's the kind of thing you see. George Soros is a big one. I've been trying to get to the bottom of that one recently because it's anti-Semitic. But then who's that targeting, right? Latinos don't have necessarily in the U.S. this long history of anti-Semitism. I think our theory is that that's operating mostly in evangelical spaces, that there's something else that folks are trying to communicate there. You have seen some growth for Trump among evangelical and Protestant Latinos. In Nevada, there was a jump there in our recent polling.
Is this focused on Florida in particular for some reason? I mean,
wait, do you mean the polling or the information?
The information.
This kind of information? No, it's not limited. It's definitely not limited to Florida. I mean, the focus groups I mentioned were in North Carolina. And the conspiracy theories, I should say, flow both ways, right? There's also just Trump stealing the election kind of stuff as well. So no, and it's not unique to Florida. What you get in Florida is unique. What you get in Florida is more about Venezuela. It's more about Colombia. It's more about Cuba. It's just memes that are kind of silly. And then you have an ecosystem in Miami that's been at the ready to amplify it outside WhatsApp. Elsewhere, you just don't have the same multi-platform ability to spread news. So the WhatsApp tends to be a more narrow channel in that regard.
All right. Well, I think we should leave it there. Carlos, I know you have somewhere to be, but thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks, everyone. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.